Dirty Moderates, think about this. What if our national problems, our divides, our fractiousness, our polarizations, what if they aren't partisan per se? What if they are broken? What if we are broken? And what does that mean? An astounding piece of journalism came out in November of 2022, which I think sheds a lot of light in a really interesting and important way on what is called brokenism. The essay was written by Alana Newhouse, who is my guest today. Alana also is the founder and editor of Tablet Magazine, a very dynamic hub of Jewish opinion, podcasts, editorial, and everything. If you don't read Tablet, you should, especially in this crazy, precarious time. Alana, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I just want to read the subtitle of the essay. The real debate today isn't between left and right. It's between those invested in our current institutions and those who want to build anew. Now, before we talk about it, it's interesting because the essay is alternately grim and hopeful. Okay. I think is wonderful, but I also think that there's a bit of a, in laying it out, and that's what I want you to address, there's a bit of, you know, if we ditch the status quo, is there some kind of, for lack of a better word, revolution that we should have? You know, and what exactly does that mean? So let's just talk about the essay. What is brokenism? Is there a new path, or is it a path of reformation, not revolution?
So brokenism was an essay that I wrote based on the idea that the formative question of the moment isn't actually about conservatism versus liberalism or the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party, but rather about when we look at the institutions of American life, and those institutions can be anything from the healthcare, so Medicaid, health insurance companies, to your kids' schools, to and universities, to cultural institutions, to Hollywood, right? Mm-hmm. When we look at all of the entities that kind of make up the production of American life, some of us look at them and say, these institutions seem broken beyond repair. They mm-hmm. seem like they don't work. And some of us look at them and say, no, these things are simply in need of some Band-Aids and scotch tape and they'll be fine. One of the things I noticed as I would, you know, Tablet would cover politics is that increasingly that was the debate that people were really having and the debate that actually was most interesting and felt the least likely to devolve into nothingness, basically, into just pure conflict. The one that had the most meaning to it was the one about the health of it, of our institutions. And it felt very exciting to me when I realized that because it felt at once both effective and also hopeful.
Okay. I'm very interested in, divide. I hate to use that word, but about the different type of people, the different way people see this thing, the status quo people the brokenness, exactly. And, you know, you make a good point here when you write about, you know, America's been very divided before. I mean, that's a terrible civil war. We've had Reconstruction. We've had Vietnam protest. You know, we've been riven, you know. And it's very difficult to see history or understand history when you're in it, right? I mean, we all look now and we say, and this, I want to bookmark this for a bit in our, a little bit later in our conversation, you know, how anti-Semitic is the left right now? What era are we living in? What does that really mean? Is it pronounced more because of social media? Is that, you know? So when we talk about the status quo people versus brokenists, you know, how does one make a distinction, right? Besides feeling that things aren't working, and I agree, I feel the same way, between, hey, we're just living through another turbulent period in a young country that has had to experiment with self-government in a way no one ever else has. You know, what's the delineation? That's the question.
So I think that there are purists on both sides. Right. There are people who approach every institution and apply the exact same ideology to it. So there are brokenists who don't actually want to look at the specifics of an institution. They just want everything burned to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There are status quoists, similarly, who will ignore deep and incontrovertible decay mm-hmm. in institutions and almost like with their teeth and nails are hanging on to them and can't imagine the world without those institutions, even as they're faced with those institutions being so profoundly deteriorated to the point of being dangerous. So I want to say that there are extremists on both sides. The really interesting conversations happen in the middle. The interesting conversations happen when among people who say, you know what, maybe we should judge this institution by institution, and we should be willing to make a clear-eyed judgment about something as we are faced with the facts of it, which means there may be some institutions that you would judge as too far gone. Other institutions that you'd say, you know what, this thing needs help, but it's salvageable and it has gold in it that we need to try to retain. And this institution, it's almost perfect. Let's keep it and let's work hard to preserve it. A healthy society would good. A healthy society will have all three of those impulses on the part of public discourse. And the people who talk to each other will actually be able to make those decisions based on what they're actually seeing in front of them, which is a different way of saying it. So to me, it's almost like what we once thought of as real independence, real political independence, right? So you could be a registered Republican or a registered Democrat, but if you looked and you were like, you know what? I actually think at this moment, the other side has a point. I'd like for us to get back to that, to get back to understanding that ideology are their tools. They're not identities. And we need to use them smartly. And what that means is using all the tools in the toolbox, particularly at moments of extreme flux.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're describing me, you know, as a hybrid who finds myself politically homeless by definition, who was raised a Democrat and absolutely is not one, who's somebody who has resisted identity politics, speaking of identity, but certainly ideology meeting identity, I think has been poisonous, not only for Jews, but I think for the country. I think there's a lot of people who can identify that as a problem and then do their own whataboutism, which is yes, but there's all these problems on the right that we have to. And I always say, just because a problem is in one camp, right? And again, the red team, the blue team, and it might be an asymmetrical threat, arguably on the right, that doesn't mean that there aren't illiberal tendencies that are dangerous on the left. I mean, you know, so sort of poo-pooing that, right, I think corrodes. Which is why I think we get brokenism, because there's people that can't get out of their silo to say that. You know, it's all Trump is horrible. I don't want to talk about anything else. Yes, Ilhan Omar is anti-Semitic, but so what? And I go, what do you mean, so what? I mean, anti-Semitism has a life of its own that doesn't like, oh, yes, we're just going to pal around with the right always. We're not on the left. It's crazy, you know? And so there's no ideological flexibility and hence no critical thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that if you truly believe that the right is an existential threat, that is a stronger argument for cleaning your own house, because must then if you really believe that you are all that's standing between democracy surviving and this moment, then what you need to do is make sure you don't have any illiberal elements in your own crowd, because you're all that stands between us and the future. So to me, there's a complete disconnects when people say stuff like that, where you're like, okay, even if I take you at face value, I think that that makes it more imperative.
I do too. I also think it. I think the ideological silo obscures the reality of history. Right? They say, well, right, it doesn't matter because, oh, don't worry about that. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I can say, yes, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is a nutcase. But I said, I think you've got 40 Democrats who are regularly and willing, openly hostile to Israel. And that could be 80, that and could be 100 of a party that can only have 218 seats. At what point does it not become a problem to you? You know what I mean? And at what point is a small tumor or a small growth not a cancerous tumor? I mean, you know, makes no sense.
Yeah. Completely. I mean, I'd also say that brokenism and status quoism is a very, it's potentially even the most useful framework to layer onto our two-party system.
Yeah.
That is a system where people are so status quoist.
Right.
They can't get out of the binary of these two parties.
Right.
Now, part of it isn't their fault. It's the system that makes political power nearly impossible to achieve outside of either one of those parties. But it still kills me that Americans have seemed to have lost the imagination that their power comes from somewhere else.
Yes. Well, I love the story that you personalize, you know, because it's, you know, in an otherwise, you know, really wonderful piece, intellectual piece, you talk about Ryan. All right, who said he's a West Point grad. I love this. Combat veteran, biracial, from a multi-generational Black military family. And I want to read what he says, what you write. Quote, I've lived in rural Ohio, he wrote. It seems very dark some days, but your closing nails it. It can almost feel easier to believe it can't be done, but it can. Here's also what he said, which I love. You write, at one point last year, Ryan said something that struck a nerve. I don't know what I identify as these days because everything has gotten so scrambled, he noted. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I don't even think I could define myself narrowly as either a liberal or a conservative anymore. The one thing I know that I fundamentally do believe is the premise of your piece, that the dominant institutions of American life in education, in the arts, in politics are either totally broken or so weak or corrupt that they're becoming irrelevant. In a way, the only thing I know that I believe is in, the only thing I know that I believe in is brokenness. And I think he is, I actually think he's where the country is. I created this podcast because of that, you know, and that's why we have everybody on or tried to. And that's why, you know, why have anybody on a show? Like, it's just an example of this, you know, and I always said the thing to you pre-show that I say to every guest to let them know. It's not a shtick. It's like, why have somebody on? Because we've had people we've reached out to and they'll say, oh, is he going to be tough on me this way or that way? Why am I'm having you on to talk to you. This isn't cable news. I did that. I've done that much of that. And it has a place, but that's not what I like. And I'm having you on, not so much you specifically, Ilana, but anybody to discourse. And if we don't do that, you know, it's like, I don't know how people can watch any of the big cable networks every night and only watch that and come away thinking, and too many people do, I've got my news. I mean, that's so broken, you know? It's so broken that, and by the way, yes, of course I'm criticizing Fox. I worked at Fox, but I'm also saying you watch MSNBC and you swallow that primetime 4 hours, which I do not, and then you go, that of course, you are worked up in a rage. Of course you see the only threat being Trump. Of course you don't see anything reported on the liberal tendencies. How could you? They don't cover it.
I know.
And it doesn't mean they lie, but there are omissions in the journalism is the way I would put it.
Completely. And I think that the, you know, we can get into it if you want to get into talking about Israel and anti-Semitism. But yeah. One of the things that I really want to encourage people to understand, which is something that is a hard lesson for me from the last 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, I have this thing that I believe, which is like the only thing worse than a dumb Jew is a surprise Jew. And you could say the same thing about Americans. Like, yeah. You don't want to be surprised in moments of historical instability and flux, which is what we're in now, because we had a technological revolution. It changed all the systems of our lives and changed the globe and the way that power is organized around the globe. And so the ground is very shaky. Mm-hmm. In moments of grounds, when the ground is shaky, the last thing you want to be is surprised. So what I try to explain to people is playing with brokenism, playing with the idea of what if this thing went away, is a healthy thing for you to do, not because I want you to burn everything to the ground and not because I want you to abandon everything, but because I want you to be prepared in case that thing falls apart.
That's right.
And not have all of your eggs in that basket. Mm-hmm. Things are falling apart faster and in more surprising ways than we know. And so one example, just to give you one, is over the summer, pre-October 7th, Tablet published a piece where we basically called for an end to US aid to Israel. And which is a surprising position for a magazine that's clearly a Zionist outlet to take. Part of why we did that was we said the structure of the aid relationship is a relic of a different time in American foreign policy, a different time in defense technology, a different time in global politics, and it doesn't serve either of these countries well anymore. Mm-hmm. Whole parts of certainly the foreign policy establishment freaked out that we said this and said, you know, that's wrong. It's crazy. That's insane. You know, you can't imagine. Don't even think about that. Don't even toy with it. Mm-hmm. 6 months later, I think there are a lot of people who have gone back to that piece and said, you know what? It was good that you got me starting to think about that. Mm-hmm. It was good that I actually had it in my head before October 7th. That maybe the world is changing and maybe both America and Israel need to change, which is not to say that they should change into not having a relationship, but that the relationship is going to change anyway. And so we should be prepared and be smart about how we change it. So what I'm trying to get people to do is almost like change their positioning and the way that they look at the world more than I'm trying to get them to believe any one idea or another one. I actually don't care what you're invested in. I'm trying to change how you think about and how you look at the world.
That's interesting. Now, I did not know about that. That is obviously, as somebody who's trying to see Mike Johnson actually emerge as a credible speaker and not get vacated by the lunatics. You know, I want Israel and Taiwan and Ukraine to be aided because of the situations they're in. Can you, before we go on, can you explain why? I mean, is there a sort of like preemptive defensiveness to this? That like, hey, if Israel's not reliant, then they don't have to listen to American critics or be beholden? How would that work? I mean, I'm not saying you have to own the position, but
it's also partially about the way that aid works. So the vast majority of the so-called billions that go to Israel is actually money that goes to American defense companies.
Yes, of course. We give them money and they buy American arms. Right.
Right. Except we are emerging in a time in American life where there are whole questions about American society and how it functions. And Americans are asking good questions about where their tax dollars are going.
Right.
And one concern that I had over the summer was that the impression that one gets of billions of aid going to Israel, when in fact, nearly almost none of it actually lands in Israel, was going to actually be quite bad for both countries. It makes America look like we're sending a lot of American tax dollars elsewhere, mm-hmm. when in fact we're not. And it makes Israel look like it's reliant on America, when in fact, and there are a couple of examples in the piece that I talk about, in fact, the technology that Israel is beholden and must buy is often not the best technology for what the Israeli military needs.
Hmm.
And so Israel was caught in a framework that made it dependent on America in ways that increasingly were not optimal for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And America, not the American federal government, but Americans we're increasingly under the illusion and the absolute misimpression that we were holding up that country when we're not.
No.
And so the whole thing started to feel like the emotions of it had gotten tangled, and it was giving it felt like it had become a corrupted relationship that was misunderstood, and it felt like one of those things where you just take a step back and you say, like, we need to reframe this relationship.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, one of the things as a corollary to that, that it gets really lost in the story is when debates come about what America should or should not be spending. But this isn't just specific to Israel. Most people have no idea that the military, Medicare, and the interest on the debt eat up most of the federal budget. So when people say, I'm so sick of the federal government and golden toilets of the Department of Energy, you know, things that are excessive, you know, why are we funding the study of, you know, gentle bears in the woods or something? Okay. You know, foreign aid, I mean, I think cumulatively, which includes, of course, Israel, Egypt, Turkey, all these countries.
Ukraine.
Ukraine, yeah. But it's like, you know, 2% or something less, I think, 1.8% of the federal budget. That doesn't mean each thing isn't worth exploring for what its intentions are or what the implications of the aid means. But people tend to conflate it with this government is not representing me and they're taking all my money. And then you say, well, okay, well, we've probably, see, I'm someone who says, yeah, entitlements are going to have to be reckoned with because we're running out of money. But then people say, no, we don't want that. So it's just an interesting corollary to it.
Right. And it's also very good to start to say.
People don't understand that. Americans understand that, though. If you go in there, the populist moment on the right, too, is very pro-big government, which I'm not. They're like, hey, don't touch a benefit. I'm not asking. I don't want to throw poor elderly widows in the street, but we got to get real. And the old Republican Party would say, hey, we got to talk about balance. But this crowd, no. It's literally borrow and spend for the things we want.
And again, think about it. It's status quoism. They're basically saying, we understand, we can't get ourselves disconnected from the way that things work right now. And neither party can. And it's so interesting, right? It's like, once you start to see it, you realize that not to say this, but you start to look and you start to see a lot of commonalities between people who ostensibly call themselves Republicans and people who call themselves Democrats. And you realize it's because they're both invested in a system working in a specific way. And that if Americans want to look at something and say, I don't think this is working for us as citizens, you then start to need your elected officials to reflect that desire for change.
I think that's right. So, in the world of brokenism, you know, and institutional decay, you know, and that's actually using a nice word. We saw since October 7th, the filth and the yuck that pervades college campuses, schools you and I went to, you know, and I went to Brown, you went to Columbia or Barnard, I believe. And, I wrote a Substack called Liberals, Leftists, and the Jews, differentiating between classical liberals. I'll send it to you. You should read that. Separating out what's happening here. You see a movement, you know, of what used to be called the liberal establishment. That's why I worried what we were saying earlier about one or two people acting illiberally, because the kind of anti-Semitism that's rooted in the kind of awful DEI/oppressive binary rooted in Marxist thinking and all that stuff. It was just what it is, because I was a political theory guy, and I've read had to read a lot of Marx. You read this and you go, wow, you see where this percolated, you see where this incubated. And like you said, we're now surprised. We shouldn't be surprised, but maybe you and I aren't, we're a very small minority, of what you see erupting into completely radical activity. And I'm not talking about just free speech. I'm talking about true genocidal talk and true hate. Great credit to Stefanik for really grilling these people. And actually the president of Colombia had to say yes, calling for the genocide of Jews. She didn't equivocate. She didn't do a Claudine Gay pod to do. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about, you know, the erosion of goodwill for Jews by way of the left. I'm not excusing the right. I just want to go into this.
Okay, so let's caveat it by saying we're not excusing the right, and we're just going to talk about the left because we care about the left, and we the premise here is that the left should not just because somebody else has a problem doesn't mean that you have to have the same problem. I think you pretty much put your finger on it when you start talking about the broader ideology. I really do not believe that anti-Semitism is a cause of anything. I believe anti-Semitism is a symptom of other problems that happen in societies historically. Those problems can be economic, as they frequently are, certainly in modern history. They can also be religious. There's a deeper challenge in the social fabric, and it comes out as the need to identify, isolate, and demonize the other. And historically, Jews serve that purpose. And so then the question is what is America going through? What's the real root of this cause? And I do think that the root of the cause is sort of the larger social and economic changes that we're going through, and the decision on the part of several institutions that then became entire industries to answer instability with essentially what can at base be called it's just Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a reframed Marxism with new words for it, but it is a flattening of difference. Mm-hmm. It's a worship near idolization of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it's communism. And so now it's trying to layer Marxist and communist principles on top of a democratic and capitalist society, which creates its own completely different new animal. But that's what you're seeing. And so to me, it's not an accident, and it's not a surprise that when you decide that you're going to orient your way of looking at the world inside of the idea of power and powerlessness, and that virtue is attached, virtue and positions of power are decided by proximity to oppression.
Right.
You're not giving power or leadership roles to people based on gifts or skills or commitment to a larger community or excellence. You are giving power based on their relationship historically or in the contemporary times to oppression. You're creating a completely different system. And that system inevitably generates what, you know, we probably 12 or 13 years ago called the oppression Olympics. It's obviously going to make people have to compete.
Yes.
Because if you must compete for oppression points, because oppression points is what gets you power.
Right.
So it 100% just reorients everything according to that and makes groups that historically had an incentive to create collaborative relationships. Great example is Black and Jewish communities in this country.
Yes.
When you have coalition politics where you reward people for creating relationships and compromising with each other and figuring out how to work together, you create coalitions. When you have a politics that makes people have to compete for each other for who can be above one or another in how much oppression they can ostensibly say they've experienced, you create absolute conflict among your cohorts that are ostensibly supposed to be this, they're supposed to make up your side.
Right.
So that's where we are on the left and the Democratic Party. And I believe that the you know, if we were, we could definitely have a conversation about all the problems with the Republican Party, which is basically like a joke of a party and an absolute mess. I think yes. that the, and has zero, anyway, we can talk about yes. that. But the Democratic Party actually is completely well organized.
Yeah.
And completely and incredibly well funded and has enormous funder and activist discipline. And is organized around some basic principles that I think are creating a lot of the problems we're seeing, but they also generate electoral wins for the party. So there we are.
I know. And, you know, and as it relates to the sort of communist Marxist principles that are being layered, like you said, into the system. The irony of the, of, you know, the competition for victimhood, right? The idea that there's this agency paradoxically in what your victimhood is. The whole movement though creates this competitiveness, this victimhood, these divisions for the belief system that insists on equality of outcomes.
Yes.
It makes no sense. I mean, you know, in other words, equity. Right. The idea that everything has to, the playing field has to be completely leveled or we're completely at every step of the way. Therefore, but there's a competition going on for who can be the most depressed in that area. Right. Everyone has agency and it's a very fascinating thing. It's just a little subtext of it to add to your, you know, all of which I think is insane, you know, and again, like you said, anti-Semitism will be a symptom of it always, but then we have now been cast as white oppressors, which I wholeheartedly reject. You know, I've been on the record during the Black Lives Matter thing. I said to everybody in my life, you will not call me ever a white supremacist. Not that anybody did, but I said, never call me that ever, 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 because that does not apply to me. Take your crap and shut your mouth. I am an ally, but I will not stand by that.
I want to go one step farther, which is I want to say that I actually find the demonization of white people as all white nationalists yeah. and white supremacists to be itself poison. And in fact, my argument is if you want to demonize people, fine, I'll go and I'll stand with everyone you want to demonize.
Yeah.
And right. To me, the idea that we have decided that, you know, the way that people use the term white girl, it's they never term or white male. These are meant to be derogatory.
Course.
And you look at them and you say, why is that okay? Like, I don't understand why that's any more or less okay than any other slur based on people's ethnic or religious identity. It is so offensive. So the whole scheme feels toxic to me. And it feels like it's meant to. So actually at some point, you know, I just look at people and I'm like, I reject the entire game of separating people out this way.
Yeah.
And I reject the game of separating it out so that they can be rewarded. Mm-hmm. And I reject the game of separating it out so that they can be punished.
Oh, absolutely. But you know, in the game of party politics and party people absolutely will, I'm sure they've confirmed it to you too. There is absolutely no question that the Republican Party is significantly, almost pound for pound, more pro-Israel than the Democratic Party now. It's not even close. In terms of being truly supportive, you know what I mean? And that doesn't mean that there aren't Democrats that are, but there's John Fetterman, but you know what I mean? There's a lot of people getting wobbly, as Margaret Thatcher would say. What do you think?
Look, I think that we are in a very weird moment. There is an emerging anti-Semitism and impulse to reframe Israel and Jews, American aid to Israel, as manipulative on the right. You can see it in the fights between Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro. You can see it in Tucker Carlson's decision to feature guests who So there's and you can see it if you go on Twitter. Some very high count, high follower count accounts. So, and the reason why I bring that up is because the Republican Party is an absolute mess. And it is like tissue paper. So, and it's not well organized. The right is not well organized. So what that means is even though you're right, and I believe that the anti-Semitism and frankly racism that is inside of institutions that are associated with the left, or with the Democratic Party, it's more comprehensive there. In some ways, the strains of anti-Semitism that are emerging on the right are more dangerous because it's like tinderbox over there. It's so weak and it's such a mess that it needs a very small amount of brainworms to infect the whole landscape. So the problems are
because there's no glue and it's this amorphous blob that can go, that can kind of like congeal in any direction.
So it concerns me, not because I look at it and I say the problem is the same. You're right that that anti-Semitism in some senses has been institutionalized. In the entities of the left. It is institutionalized in cultural organizations. It's institutionalized in our universities. It is absolutely apologized for by ostensibly legitimate authorities. And that is a huge problem on the left and among Democratic Party affiliated institutions. And it is their responsibility. I am saying that the right, it's more flammable.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point.
And so it's a different problem, but it's definitely a problem there too.
Do you believe that Donald Trump threatens democracy? Is Trump 2.0 the end of democracy, as is constantly?
No. I believe that, here's what I want to say. I believe that almost every politician in America now at a national level has the capacity to threaten democracy because the federal government has built into itself the ability to surveil and control the personal lives of more than 300 million people. That is a terrible power for the federal government to have.
Are you talking about FISA that just got renewed? Are you talking about FISA specifically? Or?
I'm not talking about FISA specifically. I'm even talking about the entirety of the disinformation regime that got built up. The enmeshment with big tech companies that have all of our personal information and social media, the enmeshment of tech companies with the Defense Department, with CIA and the FBI, the ability to actually monitor completely innocent Americans and citizens means that Donald Trump, like Joe Biden and like every other politician at a national level, is now a threat to democracy. The arrogation of that power by the federal government is the threat.
I like that. That's a great take. I mean it's a version of like the military industrial complex and its new tentacles, really, which has always been there.
But those tentacles, I think if I'm not mistaken, I think that around Watergate, the number of federal wiretaps that we had going was about I think it was 67. We have that number is in the, I don't know, hundreds of thousands now, possibly. The kind of surveillance, if not more, I actually have to find out the level of surveillance and the ease with which the federal government can control nearly every aspect of people's lives and manipulate it if it wanted to, is unlike anything that we've ever experienced in the country before. And that's the huge threat, that it's not in a person.
Right.
And it's not and frankly, I wish it were in one of these parties. But as you pointed out, it's in both of them, because they both are invested in the status quo, and the status quo has something deeply wrong with it. We have allowed the federal government to take control in certain ways that are that we're going to need to figure out how to take back.
Well, listen, I mean, you know, certainly since the Great Depression and then the Cold War, you know, the growth of the federal Leviathan and the state, you know, would only grow and grow, and that which giveth also taketh away, you know, and it's why I'm deeply skeptical of the power of government and believe that localities and states should try to do stuff. That, of course, doesn't mean, you know, our debates are so flammable, to use a great word you used earlier, that no, I'm not opposing the enforcement of civil rights laws. I'm not saying that, okay? Every statement in support of states as laboratories of democracy doesn't make us less dramatic. So, I mean, you know, I hate this. It's so childish, you know? But when I say, hey, passing more laws comes with more bureaucracy and more federal power, that's a lot of what I get upset about. And the progressive platform, and I don't mean it in a nefarious way, is the more laws you pass, the more just society is. I wholeheartedly disagree, because they misunderstand the role that government comes to dominate in our lives.
And here's another way you can frame it. You frequently, if you speak to people on the left, they will frequently tell you that America is a deeply unjust society, and it is more unjust by the day. So what is it? How did that happen? So actually, in fact, so the growth of the federal government coincided with America becoming less just? Okay, great. So, but again, it's like,
let's reduce government. No, right.
I'm all for that. Then let's talk about that. Right.
This logical conclusion. Right.
Right. Or you can tell me, no, America is more just, and we have gotten better. And as a result, I support the growth of the government in this way. Either one of those is internally logically sound, but
right.
You cannot say
right.
that the growth of the federal government has coincided with the deterioration of justice in America and the deterioration of fairness. And America is deeply, almost genetically incapable of becoming better. And then tell me that I have to deal with all these rules. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, Well, I think that, and to bring us full circle to the end of our conversation, I think that is brokenism. I think that that is inveterate and embedded to your idea of brokenism. And why... Right, there is such a lack of trust in our institutions, because that activist gambit, and that's what that is, also believes, because remember, the ulterior motive is we must burn it down so we can build this different society. So despite the illogical statement, right, oh, more laws, even though more laws you say are making us less just, then you're sort of defeating your entire, you're betraying your idea, which is, oh, yeah, we have to create a utopia, you know? It's all woven in, which I also think is part of brokenism. To end with that, given where we are in election year, and I think the essay is so evergreen, we have two choices. Obviously, people don't have to vote, okay, when I say that. You know, people can vote for third parties or whatever. Does Tablet take a position? Do you take a position? No, no.
No, so because Tablet... we never have, as long as I run Tablet, we will never endorse a candidate. Because in part, again, it goes back to what we're trying to do, which is, I don't care where you end up, mm-hmm. I care how you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care who you pull that lever for. In a way, what I care is that you're under no illusions about why you're doing it, mm-hmm. and that what you're saying makes sense. And so if you say to me, and in that respect, I do want to tell people that I get why we're all obsessed with politics. Mm-hmm. I completely understand it. I want to posit that it is possible that our obsession with national politics is preventing us 100%. From focusing more locally on the things actually we can change and affect, and that will have reverberatory consequences at a national level that might be much larger and more sustained over time. And so what I'm not saying don't vote. I'm not saying don't focus on national politics, but I'm saying watch yourself. Mm-hmm. See if that's a replacement for the energy and commitment that you need to make sure that the world around you is actually made better. You know, there's a Jewish principle, which is that you're supposed to work when you give charity to the world, you're supposed to work in concentric circles. So you're supposed to give to your immediate family, your extended family, your community, your city, your state, your nation, the world, right? And there's that principle is right, because what they're saying is you strengthen from the inside out.
Yeah.
I want to encourage Americans to get back to the idea, because that's where you absolutely have power.
Yeah.
And you will see the effect of what you do immediately.
Yeah, I mean, amen to that. To close, I will tell you that I love your point about national politics. I want to, we have a lot more to talk about. We're going to have you come back, because we're going to have to talk about the new version of the national security state. We're going to have to talk about this craziness, this illogical problem of a just society that keeps growing, an unjust society that keeps growing its government. But the national politics thing, I've said it on my show so many times, Alana, you know, everything is nationalized. You know, when the Democrats faced their own challenges with the court and all of that, I said, yeah, you deified Barack Obama and nothing else. I'm not picking on Barack Obama. That's all you cared about. And you were hollowed out at every state, local office, because you didn't care. And yeah, guess what? A lot of bad people ran school board or took over school boards, but a lot of good people just ran for office who were more conservative and won. And you guys were busy partying. I mean, you just were. And growing the idea of government and almost forming a kind of weird version of the imperial presidency, where, you know, you had popular Democratic presidents that galvanized majorities and you didn't care about the rest of the country, which alienated the country and also created, I think, a very unhealthy nationalization of our ideas, our identity. Yeah. And guess what? It led to brokenism, among many other things. Alana, thank you for joining us. This has really been a wonderful conversation. We're definitely going to have you back, because we could talk for hours. This has been my great conversation with Alana Newhouse. Make sure you read Brokenism at Tablet. Is it tablet.com or .org?
Tabletmag.com.
And tell everybody where we can find you on your socials so we can promote you.
You can't. I'm really not on any social media platform.
Oh, there you go. All right. All right. Then all the more reason to have you back. We got to find you in these hidden spots. All right. Alana, thank you for joining us. Dirty Moderates, stay dirty, stay moderate, and stay safe.